Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, shortly after the commencement of the carbon tax on our topic, Living with the Carbon Tax, and we have two speakers. Miriam Lyons, who's Executive Director of the Centre for Policy Development, a progressive think tank, others would call it a left of centre think tank, but I think a good think tank. And Terry McCran, who is Associate Editor of Business at the Herald Sun. He's a columnist for the News Limited newspapers, but also for the Weekend Australian on Saturday. Terry makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Miriam Lyons makes a welcome first occasion at the Sydney Institute. We're going to lead off with Miriam Lyons. Going to talk for about 15 minutes, then we go to Terry McCran, about 15 minutes, and we have about 30 minutes for questions and discussion. Miriam Lyons, we're very grateful you came. Thank you.
Thanks, Gerard, and thanks so much to the Sydney Institute for having me. And thank you, all of you, for coming to yet another conversation about the carbon tax. I congratulate you in advance for your perseverance and patience. I'm amazed you're not sick of it already. Look, I have a pretty simple message tonight, which is that both the advocates and the opponents of the Clean Energy Future Package are exaggerating its likely impact. This wouldn't be the first time that public debate over an economic reform in Australia has suffered from runaway rhetorical inflation as each side bids up the going rate for hyperbole. Pop quiz. Who said, when the history of this parliament, this nation and this century is written, insert date here, will be recorded as a day of fundamental injustice. It will be recorded as the day when the social compact that has governed this nation for the last 100 years was torn up. Any takers? Kevin Rudd, talking about the introduction of the GST. Free trade bulls and bears both exaggerated the impact of the US-Australia free trade agreement, one way or the other. And I think that the same is true of the Labor government's decision to introduce an emissions trading scheme, starting with a three-year fixed price, now irrevocably known as the carbon tax. There's some pretty widespread misunderstandings about the likely cost. There's a new essential research poll just out that finds that over 50% of voters think it will increase fuel prices by a lot, when fuel is, of course, excluded from the scheme, and around 40% of voters think that it will increase grocery prices by a lot, and the estimate is by about a dollar a week. And it's not surprising that many people are under this impression, given the enthusiastically dire predictions of the politicians and the commentators who oppose the policy. So I'd like to kick off and mainly focus tonight on giving a sense of context to what our next speaker has called the most egregious act of national self-harm we have ever seen in this country. When you look closely at the likely impact of the carbon tax in practice, it's pretty clear that it's hard to mount a credible fact-based argument that it's going to, in Tony Abbott's words, act as a wrecking ball across the economy. So how can we understand what living with the carbon tax will be like for most Australian households? We could start with a little trip down memory lane. So Treasury projects an initial increase in the consumer price index of 0.7% from the carbon tax. And this is an image of how that compares to past increases in the cost of living. So we go back to the GST, which is 2.5%. But interestingly, there's also the food price effect, so that inflationary effect from increased food prices as a result of Cyclone Larry in there, and also from Cyclone Yasi. And you'll see that the impact from Cyclone Larry was higher than the projected increase in the CPI from the carbon tax. just gives us a little bit of historical context. What can we imagine, you know, think back to what it was like, what the experience of cost of living increases was like in that. You know, we all know bananas went through the roof, but not everything did. So, you know, what was that like on household budgets? Thinking back to that one-off increase to the GST, what that was like on the household budgets, that's roughly what we can expect. So how else might we put this in context? We could look at where the carbon tax fits into the average household budget, so kind of breaking it down at that more individual level. So Treasury Modelling, again, expects approximately $9.90 per household per week on a standard CPI bundle, which includes $3.30 on electricity, $1.50 on gas, and less than $1 on food. All up, that's less than we're currently spending on junk food. Now, that is, of course, an average, and some people will find that utilities, for example, make up a bigger slice of a smaller income. The latest Treasury estimate is that more than half of Australian households, mostly those on low incomes, will be overcompensated by about 20%. Self-funded retirees, some of you may be glad to know, are expected to be compensated to up to three times the cost of the carbon scheme. Now, that's the estimate with no behaviour change as a result of the price to reduce consumption of electricity and gas, for example. Behaviour change is quite likely, and we know that because we've already seen that the impact of higher prices from network gold plating that's been going on in the electricity grid recently has already led consumers to reduce demand. Speaking of which, this rather complicated picture, and I'm sorry if you can't, you know, see the fine print, I haven't got the high-res versions of all of these yet. This complicated picture is really worth paying attention to. So the extra $3.30 a week in the electricity cost of the average household equates to about a 10% increase in electricity prices. You may have seen the recent IPART ruling, New South Wales, allowing electricity prices to rise by 18%. About 8.4% of that was a rise in distribution costs, 8.9% to the carbon tax. And the backstory of this, of course, is the $42 billion worth of electricity grid upgrades that are in the pipeline over a five-year period. It's a bit of an arcane system, the national electricity market, and it's always very confusing to try and get your head around. But essentially, electricity regulation in Australia currently has rules that encourage overinvestment. It has to give distributors a generous profit margin on whatever new capital spending they plan to make. You know, most businesses can only dream of having guaranteed profit on whatever they plan to spend. For electricity businesses, it's the law. This increased spending on the network has been prompted by a surge in peak demand. So, for example, every new air conditioner added to the grid, because it particularly increases peak demand, adds another $7,000 worth of grid costs for every $1,500 unit sold, the remainder of which, of course, must be subsidised by other users. So if you look at the first four bars on this graph, The 2013-2014 was the projected increase in electricity costs and the breakdown of electricity costs without the carbon price. So you see that was on a path to increasing already, and indeed it has been increasing recently. And then you look on that last two bars, that's adjusting it for the carbon tax. So it really shows you where the carbon tax contribution to electricity costs fits in the overall picture of Australia's electricity costs. What's really interesting about this story, I think, is that it has started to change, but the distributors haven't caught up with it yet. So that previous graph, that was from the Australian Energy Market Commission. They were working with slightly older numbers on wholesale demand, and most of the projected increase in electricity from the carbon tax is accrued to wholesale demand, increasing the cost of the wholesale generation. Now, there's an update just released from the Australian Energy Market Operator, which shows that national wholesale prices have actually fallen by 20% in the last 2 years, and that adjusted for inflation, they're now 30% lower than any time prior to 2011. So we've got this real reduction in wholesale electricity prices. Why have we got that? Because we've had a reduction in demand. Why have we had a reduction in demand? Because of the gold plating of the network, encouraging consumers to reduce demand. Also because of the increase in renewable energy generation. And there's also factors from the GFC and the impact of the high Aussie dollar on Australian manufacturers reducing manufacturing demand. So I think that's a pretty interesting picture. So now, how would we put this in context in some other ways? One is to look at that last major economic reform, the GST. We've already seen that it's likely to have a much smaller inflationary effect, the introduction of the carbon tax in this. Relatively few businesses compared to that reform will have to deal with the compliance costs, of course. One thing that I think is really interesting to note is that the underlying health of Australia's economy is stronger right now than it was at the time of the introduction of the GST. So that's just a little breakdown of some of the kind of underlying fundamentals of the Australian economy at the time of introduction then and the time of the introduction of the carbon tax now. That's fine. That's Australia's economy overall. What about those emissions-intensive trade-exposed businesses? I think it's worth thinking back to that electricity price graph. The price rises from the network upgrades are likely to have been much more significant than those from the carbon tax. So again, it's about putting that in context. Also, the impact of the carbon tax is likely to have been quite small compared to the recent rises in the Australian dollar and the value of the Australian dollar. So Paul O'Malley, who's the CEO of BlueScope Steel, said the key things we are facing are the macroeconomic challenges around the high Aussie dollar, high raw material prices and low steel prices. It's definitely not about carbon. And incidentally, the steel sector is actually one of those sectors, like many Australian households, that have been overcompensated under the current Clean Energy Future package. Aluminium producers, another emissions-intensive trade-exposed industry, are one of those many industries that are going to be receiving the bulk of their permits free, which results in the fact that the average carbon price impact on local smelters is equivalent to the impact of a 1 cent rise in the value of the Australian dollar. So let's just look at the carbon tax benefits in context. We've looked at the costs, let's look at the benefits, what's been claimed on the other side. So what it will do, it will reduce emissions compared to what they would have been under business as usual. The blue line there is business as usual. The green line is without counting the carbon reductions bought overseas. The red line counts them. It will set up energy accounting systems because a lot of companies will be wanting to introduce good energy accounting, which I think they will want to continue to use even if the carbon price were to be dismantled, because it will be useful to manage rising electricity costs for other reasons. What I think it may do is, together with the existing pressure on electricity prices from network upgrades, it may provide just enough extra incentives and certainly public attention for regulators to transform the electricity market in favour of consumers, encouraging demand management, for example. I quite like the Ausgrid idea of allowing networks to split demand management savings with consumers, cracking down on gold plating the grid, lowering the barriers to entry for decentralised generation. I think we could potentially end up with a far more genuinely competitive market in electricity after all this. I also think the diplomacy value will be quite high. Australia has a lot to lose from climate change and a lot to gain from global action. As a middle power, I think our best form of diplomacy is demonstration. It's quite likely that the cost of achieving the 5% emission reduction will turn out to be far less than we've expected, certainly far less than the headlines have predicted, and that would be a pretty good advertisement to the rest of the world.
Mary, have you got about 3 or 4?
Okay, no worries. What it won't do is fundamentally transform our energy production away from coal-fired power, or our transport systems away from cars and towards public transport and electric cars. So we won't get the potential benefit of eliminating all of the health problems that come with that transformation. It won't take responsibility for the embodied emissions in our exports, and it won't carry our share of the reductions in emissions needed to prevent dangerous climate change. It won't make us a world leader in climate change mitigation, but it will remove us from the worst offender list as one of the highest per capita emitters in the world. Now, to have less than a 50% chance of exceeding 2 degrees of warming, the world can only burn another 1,200 gigatons of CO2. Australia's share of that budget, if you assume, you know, sort of an equal right per capita to emit, would run out in about 5 to 8 years at our current rates. Because many other countries are also failing to carry their share of reductions, the world is currently still heading towards 4 degrees of warming. It's not a pretty world. It's not the climate the human civilization developed in. It's sufficient over time to melt all of the ice sheets, leading to a sea level rise of around 70 metres. You know, there's some fairly significant impacts there. I think it's a risk that's worth managing. Human cleverness got us here, right? It gave us the technology that allowed us to expand our population, our consumption levels, to the point where they're coming up against environmental limits. Not just climate change, by the way, but also fish, fresh water, arable land, cheap oil. You know, we're kind of butting up against a bunch of natural resource and environmental limits at once. This is about dealing with the consequences of our own cleverness. You know, I don't think this is something where you say, oh, you know, we should be so ashamed of, you know, what we've done. You know, we should turn the clock back. No, this is a risk that we've created as a result of the progress that we've made. And the next step in that progress is managing the risk so that we have the option of making future progress. It's pretty simple. You know, I think this is about proving we're a species that deserves the second sapiens that we've attached to our name. I like to think of climate change as a kind of insurance policy. The estimates of what it would cost to actually solve the problem range around 3 to 5% of global GDP. And again, to put that in context, we currently spend about 2.5% on defence, about 3.3% on insurance. I think that's worth doing to avoid an estimated net present value of climate change impacts of about $1,240 trillion. For that reason, I think that as soon as we've noticed the sky isn't falling, we should actually take the next step in building a sustainable economy and go beyond the current carbon tax.
Many thanks. Sit down over there. Miriam here. Terry, up you go. You can sit over there.
Gerard, we are having terrible trouble here.
Okay, well, look, see if we can talk into the microphone. Okay.
Right, way to go. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very good to be back. I can't remember the last time. Must be quite some time ago, Gerard. I'm guessing you probably anticipate some points of disagreement. Just a few.
Well, it's not the ABC, Terry.
when we see on the ABC, Gerard, there's plenty of points of disagreement. In the closing days of the 2010 election, Julia Gillard promised not to have a carbon tax in a very deliberate, desperate, devious attempt to win the election. Within weeks, she promised the Greens to have a carbon tax in, again, a very deliberate, desperate attempt to cling to power. Unfortunately, the second time, she dropped the devious element. She actually went through with it. And so we have arrived at the world's highest and most pervasive carbon tax. Such a birth does not speak convincingly to either the substance of the policy or the credibility and integrity of the policymaker. It hardly announces a policy exhaustively developed, despite all that discussion over many years about carbon taxes and ETSs, thoroughly thought through and held with conviction and understanding. And this is without looking too closely at the pre-seed, her role in talking her predecessor out of his and her emissions trading scheme. Thank you, Miriam. It is the single most bizarre, most destructive and pointless, literally pointless policy that any government in our history has instituted, and I don't say those words lightly. It is a policy designed to hurt quite deliberately, specifically to hurt, and will succeed in hurting every single Australian. Notwithstanding, quote unquote, the compensation. It is a policy that strikes directly at the foundation of our economy and at the very basis of our society, which is access to cheap, plentiful and reliable power. It is a policy that directly attacks our core national comparative advantage. To put it bluntly, the making of carbon dioxide or the exporting of embedded carbon dioxide. To me, it is almost beyond comprehension that a government, any government, would embrace such a policy unless reluctantly forced to do so as part of a global commitment. And that's the absolutely key, critical, central point. The entire exercise is all to absolutely no point. It can make no contribution to lowering the world's temperature. It can have not the slightest impact on the world's climate. It can have not the slightest impact on our own climate. For the purposes of my comments, I'm taking as gospel truth that the global warming science is settled, totally settled, as claimed. Indeed, the carbon tax fails precisely at that point. Because if you believe, if you truly and totally believe in the science of global warming, such a government and any competent advisor such as Treasury would advise at exactly the opposite conclusion to the carbon tax as the answer, or an ETS. How so? Because if you believe the causal link between increased emissions of CO2 and higher global temperature, go short ski lodges and beachfront properties. Get in early on those new playgrounds in Greenland, Iceland and Kamchatka. More seriously, such a believing, competently advised Australian government would be maximising the country's ability to deal with a warmer world, because if the science is settled, the world is going to get warmer. This is the first and critical point. It is now beyond any denial, now there's a word for it, that not only isn't there going to be any comprehensive global agreement to reduce global CO2 emissions, those emissions are going to continue to increase. Before the Copenhagen conference in 2009, it was possible to argue there would be a global agreement. I would actually deny that word again, but it was theoretically possible. It did require a truly monumental belief that China and India would vote to stay in permanent poverty. But for the purposes of discussion, I concede that before Copenhagen, you could just close your eyes and ears and just believe. But after Copenhagen, no way. And then came Cancun, then came Durban. And last week, Rio+20, and only the briefest passing reference to the greatest moral challenge of our time. They all increasingly confirmed only one thing, that the caravan of tens of thousands of carbon dioxide belching main chancers, reality deniers and rent seekers would keep moving on from one luxury resort to the next. But there would be no comprehensive binding deal to reduce the world's CO2 emissions. Let me make a series of what should be blindingly obvious points. If we were to reduce our CO2 emissions to zero, it would have no measurable impact on global emissions and so the climate. Global, far less local. And outside the far reaches of Christine Milne's mind, no sentient person is proposing to do anything remotely like that. We're proposing to cut them by 5% on 2000 levels. That's 4/5 of 5/8 of very little. The world's emissions are going to keep rising, despite all that talk of China leading the way on alternative energy. Yes, it is happy to lead the way by making wind turbines and solar panels to sell to the West in a 21st century variation of Lenin's maxim about making the rope for Westerners. The reality is that global coal-fired power generation is projected to increase by a net 600,000 megawatts or so by 2020. That's net after including any closures. Most of that, of course, is in China and India, which adds to about 12 times our total power generation capacity. And that's only power. That does not include CO2 emissions from industry in China, India and the developing world. What exactly does Julia Gillard think China is going to do with the hundreds of millions of coking coal and iron ore we ship there every year? What does she think is actually going on, you know, upstairs, when the coal and the iron ore get together? Is her excuse she's only the piano player in the carbon brothel? This comes back to two very basic points. We need to take the world as it is, not as some fantasy would have it. And we need to maximise our national income to best deal with the consequences of whatever that reality imposes on us. The sceptical Danish environmentalist Bjorn Lomborg makes a parallel point. The trillions, yes, trillions of dollars aimed at promoting alternative energy will, even if successful and accepting the science, the computer models and all the arithmetic, only postpone the calculated warming by a matter of months. It makes the most basic sense to redirect that money, those trillions of dollars, to solving other environmental problems like access to clean water, and reliable electricity. We might indulge ourselves by having wind farms and solar panels, but if you're living in the back blocks of Africa, we're condemning you to more burning of wood materials, and also deal with the warming that will arrive anyway. Let me make a series of other dot points. The exercise has utterly debased Treasury as an institution of credible, tough-minded policy analysis and advice. What you want from Treasury is cool, quality analysis and tough-minded advice that cautions political government against embarking on frolics and good ideas at the time. What we got was a Treasury that drank the climate change Kool-Aid and then piped it into its computers. For heaven's sake, the Treasury could actually purport to model the economy out to 2050, indeed to 2100, on the basis of a proposal that completely overturns the foundations of the economy, of all economies, hydrocarbon energy, and purport to be able to conclude it would reduce the per annum growth by just 0.1% out to 2050. Announces something seriously disturbing about the governance of this country. In essence, all that detailed modelling rested on one assumption, the analytical equivalent of, let us assume, a can opener. You know the old joke about the economist on the desert island with all the cans of baked beans, how do we open them? Easy, let's just assume. The can opener in this context is that we will invent non-hydrocarbon forms of power because we want to. We haven't yet, but we will because we now want to. It's the great vanity of the 21st century intellectual. This reached its apogee in the recent budget with the most absurd graphic I would suggest has ever been produced by an Australian government, one that purported to show where our power would come from in 2050, not 2020. Zero from brown coal would be less than 10% from black coal. Today they add to around 70%. 40% from renewables, that's more windmills than we have kangaroos, and 30% from CCS, carbon capture and storage, which is fine, except it only requires first that we rewrite the basic laws of physics, which I also thought well settled. This does not only announce that we have a government and a policy advisory elite which is not comprised of serious people, but a group which in the privacy of their delusions has taken up residence on the planet Mongo. The business community. The kindest thing to be said about too large a component of business is that it displays the naivety of a child believing in Santa Claus. The plaintive cry for certainty, which only a carbon price supposedly can deliver. Earth to Gail Kelly, Marius Kloppers and co, the only certainty you can get with a carbon price is that it will be totally unpredictable, because it denies two basic realities. What is actually happening in the world so far as energy use is concerned, as opposed to the delusions projected by the Prime Minister, her climate change minister and the rest. And why that is happening? Because in a world in which energy use is growing, the only reliable available sort is carbon-based and nuclear to some extent. I could go on. The massive coalition of interests sucking at the carbon trough. The appalling performance of the media. The way the coalition is equally compromised. Its saving grace is that Malcolm Turnbull aside, it doesn't really believe in what it's saying. And its direct action can more easily be buried when reality arrives. How I am personally offended, and so you should be, at the never-ending waterfall of deceptions and straight-out lies, carbon captured, so to speak, in the description of carbon dioxide as carbon pollution, done quite deliberately, time and time again, to stoke images of dirty bits of grit. Dirty bits of grit. Nothing to do with dirty bits of grit. But I will finish on this note. The ultimate inanity, the ultimate exercise in self-loathing, is effectively the belief that man's original sin was the discovery of fire. Thank you very much.
I will get you both up here. Both our speakers came in right on time. Miriam Lyons cut her paper a bit, but we're going to publish the full papers when the papers are published here in the Sydney papers online. So her published paper will be longer than today's presentation. Terry McCran's right on time. So now we go to questions and discussion. Before I do, I just should say thanks to CAUSE.
for the use of this fine facility this evening. Now, there are a lot of people here, and this is a rather contentious topic, so questions and comments have to be brief and to the point. So, can I just ask, theoretically, what would be the worst outcome from the implementation, and from your point of view, Miriam, what would be the best outcome? If everything went to plan. Well, let's take Miriam first. Okay. And if you just make sure you speak right into the edge of that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I think the best outcome would be that it does trigger that major rethink of what we're currently doing with Australia's electricity grid, and that we therefore do a bit of fundamental restructuring of Australian electricity regulation in the interests of consumers, and that we adapt it so that there's much more demand management, there's more incentive for demand management. I think that would be a big potential kind of side bonus. I think that the other big potential bonus would be that it ends up costing a lot less than we expect, that therefore we're able to meet that 5% emission reduction, you know, much more easily than we expected, and that when the review of the target therefore comes in and says, OK, well, we can raise our target now because we can afford it, because, gee, that wasn't nearly as dire as we'd expected. That's the best possible outcome, I think.
Terry?
What am I doing, the best or the worst outcome?
You're doing the worst.
Well, the worst outcome is the uncertainty aspect. I don't disagree, obviously, with the broad thrust of the numbers that Miriam presented, that it's not the carbon tax narrowly which is the totality of the problem. It's the totality of the whole wave of dynamic to stop any further use or to cut their use of existing coal-fired power generation, not to have any in the context of not having any nuclear energy, and so on. So the worst outcome is the uncertainty factor. And the one point of major disagreement I have with Miriam is on the demand side. If we had a steady state population, fine, but we're actually embarking on a big Australia dynamic. So a 5% reduction in emissions between now and 2020 is equivalent to something like a 30% reduction in per capita emissions as population grows. That's extraordinarily large, and part of the reason why it'll be less painful is because we won't have any manufacturing industry as we get there. No, it's not all down to the carbon tax. The carbon tax is the icing on the cake. It's the dollar, industrial relations, the reality of the world, and so on. So narrowly, Gerard, I'd say the worst outcome of the carbon tax is the uncertainty factor that it generates in terms of investment more generally across the community and malinvestment into things that don't make any sense.
So,
there's
a question over here. Yep. Yes, yeah, you're right. Yes.
Miriam, do you think it's realistic to compare the GST to the carbon tax? You've said that you think the economy, Australian economy, is stronger at this point than it was when the GST was implemented. But surely we've got a completely, quite a different economy now. You know, we've got virtually a two-speed economy, a tremendous difference between states, between areas of industry, and so on. And there is the period when the GST was implemented, our so-called golden age.
Okay, the question is it a reasonable comparison to compare the carbon tax with the GST? Let me just speak into here.
Yep. Look, I think that it is reasonable in the sense of what's the underlying overall health of Australia's economy. I do agree that the two-speed economy in Australia is a problem. Ironically, you could probably ameliorate that somewhat by, say, you know, slowing down the expansion of Australia's coal boom, bringing down that pressure on the Australian dollar, and incidentally, possibly contributing a little bit less to global emissions in the process. I think that one of the things that's really interesting when you look at people who are really kicking and screaming about what the carbon price will do to their business now, it's curious that there's so much emphasis on this as opposed to the impact of the Australian dollar on their competitiveness. You know, like you find that most respectable commentators these days will say, "Oh no, we shouldn't do anything about the impact of the Australian mine boom on the high Aussie dollar. We shouldn't even think about trying to change that." you know, that's just a natural structural readjustment in the economy. And yet, when there is a much, much smaller, you know, like I was saying, you know, 1 cent, equivalent to 1 cent rise in the Australian dollar, the likely impact on the aluminium smelters. That's very different, obviously, to the actual rise in the Australian dollar recently. So if you compare them, it's really apples and oranges. I mean, we're kind of talking about, you say the icing on the cake. It's a very small icing on a very, very big cake. You know, if it's the straw that breaks the camel's back, then, you know, here's the camel, here's the impact of the Australian dollar, and there's the straw. And by the way, the straw is compensated, fully compensated, in some cases overcompensated, for most Australian businesses. There's a really good report from the Grattan Institute on what the actual impact on emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries are likely to be. And they find that for all of the industries that aren't fully compensated, they're very unlikely to go offshore anyway. We're talking black coal export, we're talking LNG. That they're not going to make, you know, decisions about, you know, whether to be in Australia or not based on the current carbon tax. So I do think it's comparable, yes.
Do you want to respond briefly to
that? I'll just add a couple of points.
Just talking to the microphone.
I'll just add a couple of points. In one sense, it's comparable to the GST. It's like a 20%, 20-25% increase in the GST. You can think of the carbon tax as a broad-based, another consumption tax, if you wish. And in terms of the best outcome, Gerard, if we end up with that as the only outcome and it's fixed at $23 and it stays at $23 forever, it's not that bad. It will be like an increase in the GST. The difference, of course, with the GST is the GST was a deliberate exercise in tax improvement, tax optimisation. It was about making the tax system work better. The carbon tax is not about making the tax system work better. It's about deliberately achieving certain ends. You know, Miriam thinks they're desirable. They may well be desirable if the whole world was going down that path, but the whole world isn't. So it's not like the GST in terms of intent or in terms of impact.
It's not that radical to ask a company to pay for a waste product which is polluting in its effects. I mean, we've done that before. Quite possibly we've put our own companies at a disadvantage before by doing that, by not allowing them to, you know, dump their toxic waste in the river. You know, that costs a little bit to refuse to allow them to do that. It's not that unusual.
Hang on. We don't have interjections here.
I've got to respond to that, Gerard. Okay. It's not a poor analogy. It is a poor analogy.
The
injection was exactly, was appropriate in subject, if not in exercise. That's exactly the point. We're talking about carbon dioxide. We're not talking about a pollution. We're talking about a pollution only in the construct of this categorisation that if the whole world dramatically increases its CO2, it may cause global warming. And I don't want to get into that debate. I mean, we'll spend the next 3 hours on that. But it's to talk about carbon dioxide as a pollutant, like dumping your waste in a river, is exactly the point about how this debate is completely, you know, the argument in favour of it is completely insane.
Now we've got to move to our next question. Since it was a response to an interjection, do you want to respond to the response to the
Look, I think cleaning up your own mess is a pretty long-standing conservative and progressive principle. You know, if you accept climate science, and I agree, let's not get into that, but if you do, then it's pretty clear that, you know, various, you know, megatons of CO2 are causing significant damage. It's a waste product which has a damaging impact on the environment and in the future on human health and on the economy, damaging social impacts. If that's not a pollution, I think that's a semantic difference.
Okay, we're going here, all right?
Yeah, for Miriam, really. Look, your figures are great and they're pretty sort of hypothetical and you're sort of looking at a reduction in sort of carbon emissions and so on. But look, in reality, these so-called polluters are just going to put the price onto everything that they absolutely do. They're not going to reduce their amount of production. They will just put the price onto the consumer. Toyota, for instance, estimate they'll be paying, it will cost them $112 per car more to build a car. You amplify that up through all the things that they do, that's probably $700 or $800 on the cost of a car to the consumer. Now, they've now got to compete against overseas people. in this room we're in. Are these people going to just quickly just going to turn off one in every three lights? No, they'll leave them on and they'll put that price onto the rent. So when it's on the rent.
So we can talk about price elasticity if you like. Like I said, for at the household level, it's pretty clear that the electricity price increases that we've already had have been resulting in a decrease in demand. People have, shock horror, been responding to prices, responding to incentives by changing behaviour. It's you know, not an unthought of concept in economics. For different companies, the effect of a price of this level on investment decisions will be different. For some, it will make a significant decision in what they decide to do, for some not. Some companies will find it really easy to reduce their electricity demand in response to this price and pocket the difference sometimes when they're getting free permits. Some won't. But to assume that it is going to have no impact on investment decisions, that it's not going to change any behaviour, kind of flies in the face of all known principles of economics.
Okay, there's a question over here. Yeah. Miriam, in your chart, speak up a bit, in your chart on over time, I couldn't see the bottom of the thing, but it's like a 2025 or 2050, the drop off in CO2 is emissions. The largest part was coming from. Thank you. The largest part was coming from the purchase of credits overseas. Who originates these credits and who administers the origination of the credits? And how do we know they're all legitimate credits?
Yeah. That is something that there is a fair bit of uncertainty about, I reckon, which is why I think it's probably a good thing that for a period when it's actually a carbon tax as opposed to a floating emissions trading scheme, it's a fixed price and there are no purchases of overseas credits. There are currently credits that could be purchased, you know, from the European market dirt cheap. It's a situation where I would imagine that there would be fairly rigorous auditing of, you know, the extent to which those credits represent a genuine abatement. You know, at the moment, Australia has planned to have only half of its permits. There's a cap on how many permits can be purchased from overseas, which is, I think, half. So it's not relying that on for the total amount of emissions reductions. You know, I think whether or not you accept this, you know, idea of international carbon trading, you know, it's like, you know, do you like the idea of a free market in anything, global market in anything, you know? It's not necessarily any more complicated than, you know, a derivatives trading. Now, you can say that we should be putting more... You should say we should be putting more effort into abatement domestically. I probably agree with you. It would be more expensive. But, you know, we could do that.
Jerry, do you want to make a big...
I do, because you've raised a very, very fundamental question indirectly. Let me make two points about the permits issue. Why do we have permits in the system, in this process? Apart from the fact that it does mean for, it does create a more market-based process of reducing emissions, the really fundamental reason is because if we actually had to cut our own emissions by 5%, totally on our own bat, which is 30% in per capita terms by 2020, we really would be turning off the lights. It's an escape clause to allow us to have our carbon cake and keep eating it through to 2020 to the extent that we can. And one of the reasons why you've got so little impact from Miriam's slides is precisely because we're subcontracting out to the rest of the world emission cuts. But the much more fundamental point is it exposes the fundamental contradiction in the whole exercise. Because the whole exercise only makes any sense if the rest of the world embarks on the same carbon cuts. So the whole world has got to cut its emissions. Got to cut its emissions by 80%, according to the quote-unquote science, by 2050. So who's going to be selling us permits? Who's going to be saying, we're going to cut our emissions by 150%, we've got all these surplus permits to sell you. Is China going to be selling surplus permits? Of course not. So it fails the most fundamental test of logic, that if we're able to buy permits internationally, the rest of the world won't be cutting their emissions.
My question is to both speakers. Putting aside the whole environmental issue, the government, by its own admission, says that it's overcompensating this tax. The opposition says that it'll cancel the tax and it won't need to compensate people because they won't be paying the tax, so they won't have to continue with the compensation. My question is, how realistic is this, or is any future government trapped on a treadmill that it can't get off?
No, I don't think it is realistic, Malcolm. If you're going to unwind what the government has created, which started on Sunday, you really have to unwind the whole package, unless you're going to find savings somewhere else in the budget. And Tony Abbott obviously has an issue there anyway, in terms of the broader promises. So I don't think it's realistic, but certainly not applying the tax frees up. You know, it means that, well, it affects both sides of the budget, but obviously.
Only to say that it's always worth remembering that the coalition has the same emissions reduction target and a much more expensive plan for meeting it.
Okay, we've got plenty of time. We've got to be brief. Okay. Can everyone make sure you're talking to the microphone?
Thanks, sir. Terry, a question. You say we should take the world as it is, not as we might wish it to be. So I wonder why the economics profession, and particularly of your inclination, are not looking at what is actually happening in the world in the empirical evidence of the problem we're really trying to solve, which is to slow down climate change. Because if you look at the Arctic, we've seen a continual reduction in ice volumes to the point where we're probably going to be ice-free in summer by 2015 and ice-free in the winter by 2030. If you look at what's going on right now in the United States, you see major problems right across the US, which are not just this year, they've been going on for about the last decade, gradually getting worse. You say that we don't have politicians around the world doing anything. I think you're about to see a scramble in the US with all sorts of people reversing their position. And if you look at the Chinese stimulus plan, which came out about 5 weeks ago, you'll find exactly the same thing.
Okay, that's it. Right.
I'm not going to argue that. I'm not going to get into a discussion about the arguments over climate change in themselves. We'll spend the rest of the night arguing that. I do note one thing, that the Arctic, by some forecasts, was supposed to be ice-free in 2012. Now it's been pushed out to 2015. I find that dubious at best. But the bottom line is, the reality is that, okay, if this great global wave of climate reduction, carbon dioxide emissions, is going to take place, why didn't we get an agreement at Rio? Why didn't we get an agreement at Cancun? Why didn't we get an agreement at Copenhagen? Why didn't we get an agreement at Durban? And don't say that there was an agreement that they promised to map out a roadmap. There was no agreement in any of those places. And very specifically on the US, the US is embarked on a major expansion of its basic hydrocarbon uses through shale gas and shale oil. You're fantasising if you think that they're going to turn their back on hydrocarbons.
You want to respond to that, Miriam? Just make sure you're speaking.
So just quickly on the Arctic sea ice, on Terry's point, the loss of Arctic sea ice is one of the many predictions which is turning out to be happening faster than the IPCC anticipated, not slower. On the whole, the IPCC predictions have turned out to be fairly conservative estimates. The Arctic sea ice is one example of that so far. Terry, you're basically saying that it's pointless for Australia to do anything because the world isn't changing and won't change.
Yes.
Here's one thing that is changing: the shift in investment patterns in energy. So investment in renewable energy has overtaken investment in fossil fuel energy. That's a pretty fundamental shift. You have, you know, India on the cusp of what I think is a kind of leapfrog moment in technology. You're probably all familiar with the fact that many developing countries basically bypassed landlines altogether and gone straight to mobiles. This is the moment that we're in with solar technology right now. Solar PV is coming down in cost very, very rapidly. It's on a kind of, you know, the Moore's Law in computing. It's on that kind of trajectory in terms of how much cheaper it's becoming. You know, this is not unusual, right? This is what happens when clever humans work very hard to solve a problem. And that gives me some hope that we will actually solve the problem. And Australia currently seems to be completely blind about the prospect of that. The other thing that will encourage us strongly to actually deal with this problem is, of course, peak oil. You know, the International Energy Agency used to be pretty sanguine about whether or not peak oil would happen. Now it's pretty alarmed. It's getting more alarmed over time. That's going to be a major driver for us to deal with what is a fundamentally unsustainable use of fossil fuels. The idea that, you know, the history is a perfect predictor of the future, just doesn't seem real to me. You know, we can learn lessons from history, but the idea that the status quo right at this moment, we take a snapshot and that's how it will continue, it just doesn't seem right.
I've got to respond to that. The reason why, there's a very simple reason why investment in renewable energy is exceeding investment in fossil fuels, because all Western governments have made it impossible to build new coal-fired power plants. They've been built in the, and they are force feeding to the tune of tens of billions of dollars a year the building of particularly wind, not so much solar, because solar doesn't work. Wind doesn't work either, but it works a little better than solar. But there are a lot of, despite what Miriam said, the bottom line in all this is China, and China is planning to dramatically increase its use of coal-fired power generation. It's going to have a dramatic increase in wind power generation, which will be a millimetre compared to the in actual output compared to coal-fired power.
Okay, but better be quick, we don't have a lot of time.
Miriam, you mentioned that wonderful word derivatives. Carbon trading is now the fastest growing commodity market on earth. So my question is, when we've got more than 300 billion worth of carbon transactions so far, and you've got the French energy giant EDF saying that it's a new type of subprime tool which will be diverted from what is its initial purpose to encourage real investment. Given that we're looking at the tax supposedly going into an ETS, my question to both of you is, aren't we being monumentally scammed by the big end of town who really want to make a lot of money, and so do the governments, and because we know the tax isn't actually going to do anything about climate?
So, Miriam.
So there's kind of a multi-point thing. Back to the tax isn't going to do anything about climate. You know, the global problem, very small increase, you know, mostly about the demonstration effect that you can actually reduce emissions and not wreck the economy. In terms of Australia's emissions, you know, there's a small reduction there. In terms of the big end of town, look, I think there's absolutely no doubt that there are a bunch of enthusiasts for an emissions trading scheme as opposed to a straight-up tax who are excited about the potential to do a bit of ticket clipping on the way through. I think Australia has fairly well-managed financial markets. I would be less nervous about that here than in some other countries. I think that there should be very strong regulation to make sure that we don't get gaming of the system. And I think it's also probably significant to note that there is a floor price on the scheme. So it will effectively have a price that it's unlikely to drop below if the markets become, you know, fundamentally unstable. And you know, same situation as Europe. Europe gave away too many free permits. The price dropped dramatically. We've put in place something to ensure that it doesn't just collapse the market.
Jerry? I think the short answer is yes.
Yes, Ms. Lyons, you said that carbon tax would support green industries, but would it also destroy green industry jobs for those that are not supported by the government? That means the green industries supported by the government can actually just borrow the money, use a little bit, and just lend it to the money market and just make a profit on tax rate payers. I mean, the ones that can do it will be discouraged because they don't have taxpayers' money and should be left to states and local governments to use their innovation as well.
If I'm interpreting that question correctly, I do agree that there has been a lot of unnecessary overcompensation. I do recommend that Grattan Institute report I think it's called New Carbon Protectionism or something along those lines, about the extent of overcompensation that's happened, you know, pointing out, for example, that the whole carbon leakage idea is a bit of a myth for a lot of industries. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't actually take away the price effect, the incentive effect. So even if you're getting a whole bunch of emissions for free, if you can make a behaviour change, if you can reduce your electricity consumption and pocket the difference, yeah, that's maybe doing taxpayers out of something that they should have been doing already because it would have made economic sense, but it doesn't negate the impact of the scheme in driving a change in behaviour and reducing emissions.
Sherry, you want to respond to that? I think there's a question here, isn't
there? Right. Yes. You've got to be very brief. No,
Miriam, you commenced with a great speech from Kevin Rudd on democracy and the GST. That tax was put to the people in a general election. The people may wish to spend their money on junk food rather than the carbon tax. Should the carbon tax be put to the Australian people in a general election?
Well, I've got a political question here. I don't know whether anyone wants to answer a political question. It's not quite a public, but very much. But do you want to respond to that?
Well, I think it's going to be. So I'm sure you will vote with glee when that happens.
She stole the words out of my mouth.
So just as a final, just to wind up point, I mean, if...
You going to wind us up?
Yes, I am going to wind up. If the... no one's come to listen to me. If the polls are correct... and the coalition wins, I mean, if, it's a big if, but if that may happen. What's then the scenario? I mean, how difficult is it to do what Tony Abbott has committed to do, apart from politically? I mean, how difficult is it to do economically to take out take the carbon tax out?
Economically, not politically.
Well, not politically. Let me just deal with the politics first.
I think the measure of how difficult it will be politically is whether Wayne Swan's in the next parliament. If they lose every seat in Queensland and Kevin Rudd, then I don't think it'll be that difficult politically, because I think the Labor Party would probably would not want to go through a double dissolution election. Economically and functionally, it's going to be difficult. I mean, it's not going to be impossible, but unwinding the structures that have been put in place will cause difficulties and may trigger compensation payments. I don't know. I mean, it's something that it's not going to be easy in that sense.
So, in other words, it's a big job. So I think we're pretty well. Was that
probably
a good job for Malcolm Turnbull has been suggested? Okay. Well, look, we've come to about 2 minutes before the hour. I think it's probably time to wind it up. Can I just say both to Miriam and to Terry, thanks for a very good discussion. It's easy, I think, for non-economists to understand what you're both saying. You communicated both very well. Both the papers will be published. We've had a rational discussion, which is not always easy to have in this kind of topic, an understandable discussion and a thoughtful discussion, which leaves all of us a bit to think about, and certainly I've learnt something tonight. So many thanks to both our speakers for coming along tonight, and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.